Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the New Statesman podcast that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich.
This week, it's our April Book Club episode. We've been reading The Cost of Living by Deborah Levy, an autobiography in which the writer describes the process of rebuilding her life after a divorce.
We'll be discussing our thoughts about the book and hearing an interview with Deborah herself. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to a very exciting book club episode of Seriously, in which we're discussing the work of one of our favourite authors, Deborah Levy. And today we're talking about her recent memoir, The Cost of Living. And Caroline, you've interviewed Deborah Levy, which is very exciting.
Yes. Yeah, so I got her on the phone for about 15 minutes, which was a huge privilege, I felt, given that, yeah, I've been reading her work for years. And I think I have actually read her writing about this, that, you know, for years and years, she was writing these incredible plays and these novels and nobody was really reading them. Like, obviously, people were, like, especially a select few who've long been champions of her work. But it wasn't until one of her novels got longlisted for the Booker Prize in about 2010-11 that suddenly she became this, like, major literary voice in Britain. And that's how I discovered her. So I sort of went back and read other things after I read that and have been following her since. Yeah, she is this incredible literary brain and she has so many interesting thoughts about form as well as content. I think she's really up there with like the best of the best.
Totally. And she's written a lot about writing, I feel like, as well, both in her fiction and in her other work. So The Cost of Living is by no means a sequel, but it follows Things I Don't Want to Know, which is a book she wrote a few years ago that kind of responds to George Orwell's essay, Why I Write. And in that, she kind of talks about how the experience of writing as a woman might be different to the experience of writing as a man. And in that, she says, perhaps when Orwell described sheer egoism as a necessary quality for a writer, he was not thinking about the sheer egoism of a female writer. Even the most arrogant female writer has to work overtime to build an ego that's robust enough to get her through January, never mind all the way to December. Which is obviously funny, but also says something, I think, about some of the challenges that some women writers, I'm sure, experience. And I think that's something that really came through in this work, The Cost of Living, is how she's had to basically, it's a banal fact, but totally reorganize her entire life around writing in order to be a successful writer. Obviously, that's just a given. When you're going through a divorce and you've got two children and you're moving home and you're trying to make that divorce as smooth as possible for your kids and so on, that's a real challenge, especially if you've like lost your office, which is a very practical challenge to face. But it also kind of brings to the fore more intellectual challenges as well. And that's something that I really felt reading this book, is how all the practical problems and obstacles that she has to overcome in order to write are also kind of intellectual ones and also ones of patriarchy. They're all mixed in together.
So she talks a bit about this in the interview, but she describes The Cost of Living and Things I Don't Want to Know as living autobiographies. And her longtime obsession is this idea of being able to write memoir in the present tense, essentially, rather than it being something you do at the end of a life and you're looking back and therefore it's all in the past and you're looking at it with hindsight. She wants to write about what's happening to her and what she's feeling in the moment, and for it to feel like that for the reader as well. And this is why she's very interested and preoccupied by the idea of, when you write memoir, you're never really writing the whole of yourself. You're never writing your absolute personality or being onto the page. It's always like a character that you construct in order to tell that particular instance. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting in The Cost of Living how she slightly shifts and changes from the different anecdotes that she's relating. And she is telling you things that have already happened, but she's trying to make you feel like you're watching them as they happen.
Mm-hmm. And it means that this is quite a material book in lots of ways. The flat. So she moves out of her family home into a flat, and that becomes like a big character in the novel. And she's, you know, should I paint it in colourful paint, or how do I make it a livable space? How do I get my shopping all the way up the hill that it's on top of? These questions then like come into the foreground in a way that I actually really loved, because she's such a beautiful writer when she's describing things like bees or oranges rolling down the hill or whatever it is. That level of immediacy and that level of intimacy that you get from the detail of the mundane is just really beautiful in this.
Mm, yeah, there's a quote I wrote down from it actually quite early on. She says, all writing is about looking and listening and paying attention to the world.
Yeah, which is definitely what she's doing here.
Yes, and actually at the start of Things I Don't Want to Know, she has a bit where she's looking back into a notebook from many years before, where she'd just taken some notes about like what happened on a flight she was taking to Poland and what it was like. And then she reflects later that actually, hang on, I used all of this in a novel 20 years later. So those details were still present to her, even if they were in the past, and they sort of found its way out into her writing eventually. Mm. It's a short book. It's not massively long. It's about, 150 pages, something like that. And it's quite spacious and easy to read, but you can also spend a very long time reading it because there's a lot to unpack inside it. In that sense, it reminds me a lot of Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts, in that it would be possible to like read that in one sitting, but it's also possible to read it for several years, I would say.
One thing that I really enjoyed is having read some of her fiction, specifically Hot Milk, which this book is written during the writing of Hot Milk. So then you get all these like little allusions to details that then appear in that book. So, you know, she might be having a thought about jellyfish, and that then becomes one of the major themes in that, or motifs and images rather, of that novel. That was really fascinating to me to see how those things are being held in her mind at the same time as she's kind of like thinking about her new electric bike.
She loves her electric bike.
I actually love the image of her like whizzing up and down that, you know, the hills in Hampstead on this electric bike. But it's interesting how to think about how she must have to hold so many different things in her mind at once, and how there's, you know, another story behind the writing of any novel, essentially.
Yes, and this idea that even when you are, I think, as celebrated and well-respected writer as she is, you don't just get to do the sort of idealized thing where you like sit in the shed in the garden and it's always beautiful summer and you look out the window and then you just write your novel from beginning to end. That's not how it works at all. And I really appreciate how she describes all of the times when she's like freezing cold or like fumbling for the keys in the dark, and how she's having to just say yes to like every bit of work she's being offered, like reviewing and all that kind of stuff, just to sort of keep the home comfortable for her daughters and like keep everything going. Because, yeah, the divorce is the major event of this book, in that it sets off all the other events, all the other changes. But also every so often you get this little passage that's about, you know, why did we ever think that this was going to be a lasting love when we didn't even really want to, you know, be in the same room with each other and all of this kind of stuff. There are just these little instances where she talks about the marriage of like intimacy and domesticity and that kind of thing.
Totally. Even the title, The Cost of Living, it holds all those ideas in it at once. Like, yes, there's a financial cost to getting a divorce and rearranging your life in that way. And there's an emotional cost. And the sense of the word living is interesting to me, because there is a sense where her life would have been easier and more manageable and more financially easy to navigate if she'd stayed in her marriage. But there's another sense where, if she had stayed in her marriage, would she really have been living? And there's a lot in this book about the price of freedom and how much it costs as a woman to be like, do you know what? I'm doing my own thing. I have my own independent career and emotional inner life and things that I need. and I have to organize my life around those things. And even though she actually kind of stops shy, I think, of spelling those concerns out for you in a way that I really like, occasionally she'll be like, oh, and then I started thinking about how difficult it was for me to organize my life in this way. But most of the time, she's literally, as you say, talking about things on a much more quotidian level. But that allows the questions to come into the narrative without being reductive ever. It's never like, it's hard for a woman to write, you know, it's never talked about in ways that diminish experience. It's always talked about in ways that are pulled out of experience. And that's something that I really appreciate about the writing, because it means that you never reduce concepts like writing to, you know, idealized stereotypes or challenges that have no redeeming factors or whatever. It's just a really good way of exploring the reality of those questions.
Yeah, and one of the ways she does it as well is by being what she called, when we spoke, in dialogue with Simone de Beauvoir and the second sex. And at one point she describes de Beauvoir, you know, having this marriage with Sartre and how it was also tempestuous and also bound up with the way they worked and thought. And then she has this lover in Chicago who just absolutely loves her for who she is. And so Levy kind of writes about, you know, she has this vacation almost like in his home where everything is because he's chosen it and he's making it like that for her. And he wants her to move there so they can live like that forever. And she just can't do it because part of the tumult and the difficulty is part of how she works and thinks, and she can't give that up. So yeah, it's all very intertwined with some quite high level critical stuff, I think.
There's a wide pool of references and she makes so many references. And one thing I really like about the way that she's referential in her work is that she doesn't, again, spell it out. So she'll be like, a Joni Mitchell song was playing about loving and hating. And she won't say, oh, I was listening to Joni Mitchell's All I Want. She'll just say Joni Mitchell was singing about loving and hating. And that, for me, if you know the song, it's actually a way more exciting way to read a reference, because you pull out the lyrics that she's talking about without boring you by like quoting the exact lyrics. You think more interestingly about the song itself, because you're not just like, oh yeah, I know that song. You're like, oh, that's an element of that song. Yeah, of course, there's like the double-edged sword in that song. Whenever she references anything in that way, it's really subtle and really nuanced, and it allows the you know, element of popular culture that she's bringing into the narrative to kind of have its own life. And I really like that. And I also think it's really funny. She writes often with like a slightly arched eyebrow about things. Like even Simone de Beauvoir, she'll be like, well, I guess I never ended up quite in the same situation as Simone de Beauvoir, but the thing we did share is this. And she says it in a way that you're quite like, oh yeah, that's a funny little joke to make. And I feel like a lot of the time she kind of writes with this detached, cool humour about the things that are happening her. She's always able at a remove to kind of make a quite gentle mockery sometimes of the things that are happening to her. And I really like that, because obviously these are big and serious questions, but she's never so detached a figure that she can't laugh at the fact that she's had like a leaf in her hair while she was at a major meeting.
Yes.
And in that sense of the personality of her coming through the page, I really appreciate those moments of levity and those moments of kind of wry humor in the book. They're really nice.
Yeah, they absolutely make it. I think in different hands, this kind of work could be quite like po-faced and quite, quote, heavyweight in, and I mean that in a pejorative sense. This is absolutely heavyweight in an intellectual sense, but it's the writing is not heavy and it's not stuffy or anything like that. You know, as you say, it is funny and it is light and it is sometimes silly. Like, I really like the description of the party that she goes to.
Yeah.
Where she sort of says, in, as you say, with that sort of arched eyebrow, like, we actually kicked off our shoes and danced just as the song was telling us to do that, you know?
Yeah, that's another great reference, when she references Bowie without really saying we were listening to Bowie's Let's Dance. But, you know, when you kick off your red shoes and dance the blues, like what song she's talking about, which I really... Yeah, and one of my favourite lines in it that's just stuck in my head, I don't know if I said this last week, but is when she says, Medusa was a woman who was very powerful and very upset.
Yes.
Which just makes me laugh so much because it's so funny, but it's also obviously really true, and it says something quite truthful about like female rage and you know, the way that we have been encouraged to perceive female rage you know, it just really funny. And there are so many lovely little moments in this book. So it's really, really worth reading for highlights like those.
Yeah, so now we're going to hear from Deborah herself. And at the end of our interview, she also read a passage from the book. So make sure you stay tuned for all of that.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
So now I'm joined by Deborah Levy, the author of The Cost of Living, as well as many other books. And she's joining us to discuss this new instalment in what has been called her living autobiography. Deborah, would you say that's an accurate description of what you've written?
Yeah, in a way it is, because my understanding of most autobiographies is that they're written at the end of one's life in retrospect. And I wanted to write in the present tense about life while it is being lived. So I couldn't think of a better subtitle than that. The Cost of Living, a Living Autobiography seems near enough.
And so you said you wanted to write in the present tense. So the experiences that you recount in this book, they're all things that are still happening to you.
Well, they're written at the time when they were happening and a little bit afterwards. But The Cost of Living is the sequel to Things I Don't Want to Know. Mm. And that was written in my 40s. And it started off as a kind of extended essay in response to Orwell's 1946 essay, Why I Write. And Orwell had found four brilliant headings to describe what drove him to hammer the keyboards. And so they were political purpose, historical impulse, sheer egoism, aesthetic enthusiasm. And I decided to give those headings a spin from a female writer's point of view. And I discovered, it's not a new discovery at all, Montaigne did it way before I did, as have many other writers, but that writing an essay in the present tense was really interesting. It was political, and that one could go really very deeply into personal experience and come out the other side saying some things about the world that were not didactic, because I write I don't write prescriptive books, I write reflective books. And so The Cost of Living is a partial autobiography. They're about big things that happen in the time frame of about 3 years of the narrator's life.
So you mentioned that you write about the events as they're happening. What sort of form does that take for you? Do you keep a journal, or do you take notes and then write into narrative later?
Well, they're written at different times while they're happening and after they've happened, because that's the way a writer makes sense of them. But my point is, Caroline, that is that they're written in the present tense. They're not written retrospectively years later with the wisdom of hindsight, that sort of thing. And so the cost of living isn't chronological. Most autobiographies, I think, you know, start in childhood and then move through a life. But in Things That I Want to Know and The Cost of Living, childhood comes to chase the adult in the living present tense. And I look at the ways that the past is always in conversation with the present, in all our lives. So the cost of living starts with a marriage hitting the rocks, with dismantling a home, and then the task of creating another sort of home. And it goes into quite a lot of detail, domestic detail, about that.
And I absolutely loved what you wrote at the beginning, this metaphor of the boat and feeling like if you had to swim back to the boat, you would surely drown, which is obviously the opposite way round to how people normally think about it. And this idea of embracing chaos rather than running away from it. Is that something you came to in the moment, that feeling?
Well, I think change is good, can be good. And although, you know, as I say in the book, we all fear chaos, and we want to be able to have some idea of the future, and we work very hard to make stable, predictable lives. And so I did come to see the changes of that time as good changes, as creative changes. And so in a way, it's a joyous book. It's not a book about suffering and endurance and sacrifice, not at all. It's a book about making a new composition for life and in life and what that's like, the hard days and the better days.
There's another part quite near the beginning where you talk about seeing a man crying at a funeral and crying like a woman, and then sort of posing the question, have I ever seen a woman crying like a man? And sort of gender difference in terms of emotional resonance seems to run through the book quite a lot. Is that something that you've been thinking about for a while?
Oh, yeah. I mean, gender as a performance is something that I look at in all my books. What's masculinity? What's femininity? All of that. But in this book, I suppose that there's a thread that goes through, which borrows from the language of film, which is about major and minor characters. Because when you write a film script, you always ask to decide whose film it is, who are the minor characters, who are the major characters. And so if we apply that to our own lives, it's quite interesting to think about. And as Simone de Beauvoir had pointed out in The Second Sex, and The Cost of Living is in conversation with that book, and it's also in conversation with Audre Lorde's brilliant essays such as The Master's Tools Will Never Dismantle the Master's House, and her poetry, all of which have been recently collected into a new anthology published by Silver Press called Our Silence Will Not Protect Us. So, you know, it's a book that leans and is in conversation with other thinkers. So my point in The Cost of Living is that women are not minor characters, they're major characters. And there's a search for a major unwritten female character in this book, because if we think about sort of vintage ideas of femininity, They're always to do with cheerful suffering and endurance and sacrifice. And these seem to be talents that I think we could lose. And all of that. And then there's also a discussion about shifting masculinities and femininities. And my book doesn't fix. I'm not really interested in fixing anything. It's a fluid book. It's a conversation with readers about some of these matters.
That's actually the next thing I wanted to ask you about, this idea of a conversation with readers, because it's been a long time since I've read a book that has made me feel so much like someone was talking to me, but at the same time, not telling me what to do or how to be, just
you're good
relating, you know. And I wondered, when you're writing, how do you imagine that conversation, or does it come later once the text is complete?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think all writers have to find a tone, a voice to speak to readers, to speak with. And and nonfiction is exactly the same, because you have to kind of invent a character that's close to oneself, through which to speak. And so I guess the tone in Things I Don't Want to Know and The Cost of Living is intimate, but it's also quite formal, isn't it? You know, it's But it is an intimate conversation about life and all the things that, some of the things that we might feel too ashamed to voice or to, to speak out loud about loneliness and loss and feeling strong one day and not and vulnerable another day. So the idea that it's an empowering book, or it's a divorce story, all of that is not really correct. It's a book about all the dimensions of in this case a female life, in which we can feel many things at the same time.
Because I suppose the previous instalment began as you said, a sort of female writer's idea of the Why I Write essay. So that idea of expressing that woman's version, or a woman's version, that's been part of the project from the beginning.
It did become that, didn't it, in Things I Don't Want to Know? Because if you give those four brilliant headings from Orwell, a spin from a female writer's point of view, it's going to be a different story, because we inhabit the world differently, just to go back to de Beauvoir, her comment that these are all so obvious, we really shouldn't even be having this conversation, but you know that there's one subjectivity, and that subjectivity is male, it's still quite pervasive. And so it seems radical to write about female experience in one's 40s and in one's 50s in particular, when there is so much there's sort of pressure on women to shut up, because that's what the patriarchy is there to do. It's just to sort of shut up women, to silence them. And so I think it is radical to write about making a new composition for life in the way that it unfolds in The Cost of Living. And as Rebecca Solnit points out in The Mother of All Questions, for all women not to be pinned to one single story about what the good life might be.
Yes, I think above all, if I took anything from your book, it's this idea that life is many things, often sometimes at the same time, and
exactly.
trying to pin it to one particular thing is a futile and limiting thing to do.
That's a reductive thing to do. It doesn't describe our lives as fully as we live for them. And I guess also the cost of living is the big things in life, aren't they? They're sort of separation and death. And I write quite a lot about my mother's death, but I also write about the mother as a delusion the societal system creates and loves the delusion actually more than the woman.
Mm.
I wondered, Caroline, if I should read a bit from the book for your podcast. What do you think?
That would be lovely if you've got a bit you think would work.
There is a photograph I have kept of my mother in her late 20s. She is sitting on a rock at a picnic with friends. Her hair is wet because she's just had a swim. There is a kind of introspection in her expression that I now relate to the very best of her. I can see that she is close to herself in this random moment. I'm not sure that I thought introspection was the best of her when I was a child and teenager. What do we need dreamy mothers for? We do not want mothers who gaze beyond us, longing to be elsewhere. We need her to be of this world, lively, capable, entirely present to our needs. Did I mock the dreamer in my mother and then insult her for having no dreams? As the vintage story goes, it is the father who is the hero and the dreamer. He detaches himself from the pitiful needs of his women and children and strides out into the world to do his thing. When he returns to the home that our mothers have made for us, he is either welcomed back into the fold or becomes a stranger who will eventually need us more than we need him. He tells us some of what he has seen in his world. We give him an edited version of the living we do every day. Our mothers live with us in this living, and we blame her for everything, because she is nearby. At the same time, we try not to collude with myths about her character and purpose in life. All the same, we need her to feel anxiety on our behalf. After all, our everyday living is full of anxiety. If we do not disclose our feelings to her, we mysteriously expect her to understand them anyway. And if she moves beyond us, comes close to being a self that is not at our service, she has transgressed from the mythic, primal task of being our protector and nurturer. Yet, if she comes too close, she suffocates us, infecting our fragile courage with her contagious anxiety. If our mother does the things she needs to do in the world, we feel she has abandoned us. It is a miracle she survives our mixed messages written in society's most poisoned ink.
That was wonderful. Thank you. I felt very privileged to have that read to me down the phone.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts, where you could leave us a rating and a review if you fancy. It makes us happy, and it also helps other people find the show.
If you'd like to come and see us in person, check out the events page of our website, seriouslypod.com/events. Details of our next pop culture quiz and anything else we're doing will appear there.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're Seriously Pod on all of them. Follow us to keep up with what we're up to or to chat to other listeners about things you've enjoyed on the show.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show or hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.